was saying to my friend John Banks, it's about time we do another episode of the podcast. So here we are, Antietam and Beyond, Tom McMillan with my co-host John Banks. Hey, John.
Tom, what's going on, man?
A little Civil War stuff here. Really intriguing guest today, folks. Author Stephen Cowie. Steve has written a book, When Hell Came to Sharpsburg, The Battle of Antietam and Its Impact on the Civilians Who Called It Home. A topic of this battle and this campaign that's rarely delved into. I've heard Steve speak many times. I think you're really going to enjoy it. First of all, though, we always do a little back and forth repartee, John. What have you been doing Civil War-wise?
A lot, but mainly I've been doing some deep thinking. And every year about this time, Tom, in early April, I start thinking about Robert E. Lee's retreat deep into Virginia. And 2 years ago in Deatonville, Virginia, I visited a fascinating place way off the beaten path. It was an abandoned plantation house called Bachelor's Rest that was used as a U.S. Army hospital in the waning days of the war. And Tom, this place was surreal. It was like something out of the Twilight Zone. Walked inside. There are clothes hanging from hangers in a closet. The back wall has fallen down. The place had been empty, abandoned since the 1970s. I go walking around. I saw an IRS form from the 1950s, a get well card from the 1960s that sadly I actually opened up. I felt like I was invading somebody's privacy, but no one lived there. In this place, the main reason I went there was to two gentlemen who took me there, Joshua Lindenmood and Michael Meehan, took me upstairs to see where writing on the wall from U.S. Army soldiers who were treated at this hospital. Eventually, that wall was removed from this abandoned plantation house because the owner had no intent or interest in saving it. And eventually, this will be displayed at the Sailor's Creek battlefield if it's not already. So every year, the last couple of years at least, around this time, I start thinking about Lee's retreat and this amazing abandoned plantation house out in rural Amelia County, Virginia. What have you been up to?
You do the exotic stuff. I'm here in Gettysburg now. We did a real Civil War nerd thing over the weekend. Richard Condon, our friend, National Park Service Ranger at Catoctin now, also runs Civil War Pittsburgh. He had a housewarming event at his new place in Gettysburg. And it was Civil War nerddom on steroids. It was Pete Meal and Cody Ish from Seminary Ridge Museum were there, and Dana Shope, late of Civil War times, and now with the Frederick Museum of Civil War Medicine. James Broomall from Shepherd University runs a Civil War program there. We nerded out. That was great. And I really hope Rich is a young rising star. I think really hope he ends up at Harper's Ferry or Antietam. I don't think he would mind that either, but we'll see where his career goes. And the other thing I did, this is a little off the beaten track, but John Schilt, and I know Steve Cowie knows him, veteran, respected historian of Sharpsburg and the Battle of Antietam, has written about 35 books. The Institute is re-releasing one of his books, Roads to Antietam, and I was honored that they asked me to write the updated foreword. So I was able to write a little, nice little piece about John and what he's meant to all of us. I know when we get to Steve Cowie, he wrote a little foreword or a tribute in Steve's book too. So everybody, the Antietam community is all kind of hand in glove. We all connect. So those were two little cool things, but I really appreciate the honor they asked me to do of writing a foreword to John's re-released book. But to our guest now, Stephen Cowie, author of When Hell Came to Sharpsburg. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Tom, John, thanks so much for inviting me on your show. I really appreciate it.
The thing is, when you read the synopsis there, and I've heard you speak and I've read the book, so I have a little bit of an advantage, but 15 years of research, intricate research, fascinating stories, so much detail. What got you interested in doing this particular part of the battle and the campaign?
Well, that's a journey in itself, Tom. I'll try to give you as brief an answer as I can. But it started, with my childhood, as many of us can share the experience of being bitten by the history bug at an early age. I was no different. My father taught social studies, and he really enjoyed talking about the Civil War around the dinner table. So as I got older, though, My interest shifted, after graduating college to filmmaking and screenwriting. And it was I got into the film business. I won't get into too much detail going into what I did in the film business as far as all the works on the feature films and so forth. But in between those projects, I was writing feature-length spec screenplays. And spec means nobody was paying me to write them. I was writing them all on my own accord with the hopes of selling them. But this all comes to answer your question. It's going to come to a point right here in a second. After writing a number of screenplays and working in the film industry for about 12, 13 years, that's when I had a rekindling of interest again in the Civil War. It hadn't gone dormant, but it was after I'd read Shelby Foote's trilogy, and then boom, boom, you have the Ken Burns series, the movie Glory. A couple years later, you have the movie Gettysburg. All this fueled my interest in the Civil War, but specifically towards Antietam. Shelby Foote's trilogy was the first impression on Antietam. After I closed the last page of that 3,000-page trilogy, I had just had one battle that I couldn't get out of my head, and it was Antietam. And the next thing you know, with the Burns series and the introductory scene of Glory, those scenes depicting Antietam had powerful made a powerful impression on me. Just left me wanting more. But I was in California working in the LA film industry at this time. I didn't have access to visiting the Sharpsburg battlefield. So it wasn't until I made a life change and moved to Tennessee. My wife's from Tennessee. That's the Cliff's Notes version of how that story unfolded. But so I suddenly found myself having access to all this wonderful history and the eastern part of the United States. And the first place that I visited was Sharpsburg, grabbed a hold of me. Just the wonderfully preserved properties in the area, not just on the battlefield, but you drive down these country roads and you come across just these stone barns and stone homes, and just the preservation up there is fantastic. It's like stepping back into time. So I knew at that point that I really did want to write about Antietam, and it was now I had the opportunity to marry these ideas together, where I'd been writing in the film industry and I had a passion for history. I said, boom, I'm going to bring this together for the first time, and I'm going to write about Sharpsburg. I just don't know what the story's going to be yet.
Steve, here's what I'm wondering. And you give a nod to Kathleen Ernst in your book, and she wrote Too Afraid to Cry probably 15, 20 years ago about the civilian experiences in Sharpsburg. Why write this book? There's already been a book done on this topic. What do you bring to the table in your book that perhaps she may have not?
Kathleen sparked my interest in the civilian side of Antietam, because when I began my research, I was strictly focusing on the military aspects, not only of Antietam, but of the entire 1862 Maryland campaign. So I spent several years just wanting to learn what transpired with those particular events. But, I eventually, after reading Kathleen's book, I thought, oh my goodness, first of all, she did an amazing job covering what it was 10, 12 towns impacted by the Maryland campaign. Her scope was very wide. The information was so fascinating that it left me wanting to learn more. And as I began studying the Sharpsburg district proper, and I saw the census listings, it was about 2,400 people living in the district in 1860. I thought, where are all the other stories? Here you have all these people living there. They were witness to one of the most important events in American history with Antietam. They had to have had accounts. Where were they? Because Kathleen had fascinating pieces of evidence in her book, but I was just thirsty for more. And so I decided that's when I was going to take a deep dive with my book into the genealogies of these people. And that led me to the war claims. So those latter two, with the land records research and so forth, that's really what I think what separates Kathleen's book and mine. They're both perfect counterparts for anyone wanting to understand the civilian experience. Kathleen gives a wonderful version of the big picture, and I go into the nitty-gritty details.
As far as the land claims, and I'm going to do something I haven't done on the podcast before. I'm going to read an excerpt from your book, but it kind of sets up the kind of thing that fascinated me when I first started hearing you speak and then reading your book. In terms of destruction, the Mumma's suffered the worst. Fire destroyed the family's house and possessions, including their clothing, furniture, and beds. Additionally, the Mumma's lost dozens of items, including an 8-day clock, sleigh blankets, a buffalo robe, parlor stoves, and 3-ply carpeting. The blaze also consumed the barn, destroying grains, plows, wagons, and a McCormick Reaper. Samuel Mumaw Sr. estimated the structural damage at $3,400 and petitioned the U.S. government for a total charge of $9,255.28. The losses translate to more than $250,000 in the contemporary U.S. money. $250,000. Just one family. It's fast, and I'm sure that these are the kinds of things that fascinated you as you dug into a famous family there, kind of the Mumaws, but other lesser known families.
Absolutely. You know, when we think of the Mumaws, that, you know, because they had such a stately farmstead and so many children, so many, you know, the wardrobes of all those children were destroyed in the fire, except for the clothes they had on their backs and whatever they might have packed into a couple baskets. But you know, when we look at other people, that the Mumaws were one family that were made homeless by all the destruction of Antietam. But there were others. There were two widows in the town of Sharpsburg named Margaret Shackelford and Sarah Himes. Their homes were completely destroyed by fire. We know this because they filed the war claims. And there were witnesses that went and stood before Sharpsburg's justice of the peace and swore to the veracity of the items in her claim, and, you know, made reports on her, you know, charred ruins and on her property. And there were also other barns in the area. Now, when we think about it, it's just a barn. Well, we have to think about what was inside the barn at the time. Some of these farmers were in the process of threshing the wheat, their most important cash grain, which was inside their barn, their hay crops for the year. The hay was reserved for feeding all their horses and their other animals. And a lot of these people were in the process of transferring all their cured timothy and clover hay into the barns. All these processes varied. Some people hadn't gotten around to it yet. And that's why we have all the soldiers' accounts of, you know, hiding behind haystacks and seeing wheat stacks in the field. Not all of this had been completed yet, but some farmers like Samuel Real had moved a lot of their hay into the barn. So not only do you lose your crop, but now you have all that dried grass in your barn, which is going to make the fire spread even worse. Then all your farming tools are inside there, like some of the items that you cited and that you just mentioned in the Mumaw's claim, you know, and you have plows, wagons, all your chickens are inside there. And we say chickens, some of these farmers had 200 to 300 of them. You know, these were large farming operations. So what do you do when all your tools and implements are destroyed, along with all your 1862 crops that were in the barn? It was just a terrible time.
Steve, there's two families I want to zero in on. And for a couple of reasons, the William Roulette farm, and then the Samuel Piper farm. William Roulette, I got to know his great great grandson. I think I have that right, Earl, who lived on Main Street in Sharpsburg, and I used to go visit with Earl, and he used to pull out artifacts that had been handed down through his family. So tell us a little bit about the William Roulette farm, and the house still stands there. It borders, part of the property borders the Sunken Road or the Bloody Lane. And then the Samuel Piper, I think I have that right, Samuel Piper farm across the way, which was used as Longstreet's headquarters. Do I have that right?
Well, the Piper family was a big family. You have that almost right. Henry Piper was the owner of that battlefield farm. There was a Samuel Piper, though. There were two. Samuel D. Piper was Henry's son, and he tenanted a farm that was just right outside of Sharpsburg on what is now Mondale Road. And then Henry's brother, Samuel I. Piper, he had a large farmstead that was joining the river near Lock 40, which is northwest of the battlefield in Sharpsburg. So yes, the Piper family, yes.
So the Roulettes had scores of bodies buried on their property, right? So can you tell us a little bit about their experience? Like, I know William Roulette pops out of the cellar door as troops from Connecticut are advancing past his house, and he yells, "Drive them," and et cetera, et cetera. Tell us what life was like for him after the battle.
Yes. Well, you know, like what you just mentioned, John, you know, the Roulettes, along with the Mumaws and other people on the battlefield, they skedaddled. They fled on September 15th when the armies arrived and started exchanging cannon fire. But after fleeing north to the Manor Church, William Roulette and several other residents also did the same thing. They were worried about the status of their property and all their valuable, especially when you leave your horses behind. That had to have really gnawed at Roulette because he came back that evening to check on his horses. And guess what? The horses had already been stolen by soldiers. But he decided since it was dark, he was going to go ahead and stay there at his house. What happens the next morning? The Confederates are occupying the farm, the battle erupts, and now he's trapped in his cellar. So not only does he have to go through the experience of, having to, be trapped in a cellar as the sunken road breaks out, but he's liberated when the Union troops occupied the farm. We don't know exactly which route he left the battlefield because that's kind of a mystery, and I can get into that why, because there is a Samaritan on the battlefield somewhere who helps out Graham's battery. That Samaritan has never been documented and identified with primary source evidence. So we have to wonder where William Roulette might have been before he went and rejoined his family. I don't want to get into conspiracy theories with where he was and to say that he was the Samaritan. But nonetheless, the family comes back. They find the farm completely commandeered by the Union Medical Department. Bodies everywhere, right? Just like the Mumma family, just like the David R. Miller farm. You have mass burial trenches all over the farm. Everything in the house has been taken for use for hospital purposes. You have surgeons occupying the farm. You have amputated limbs piled outside of the barn. It was just a scene of emergency with all the crude structures that had been built on the Roulette farm, similar to what we see in some of the Gardner and Gibson photos, like, for example, on the Otho B. Smith farm with the crude huts and shanties that have been created with the farmers' crops to provide some sort of shelter and shade for the sufferers. So it's a giant hospital operation. The livestock's been butchered. All the family articles have been taken, like the clothing and so forth. And what happens is there's a disease outbreak that erupts after the battle. And I can get into more details about that in a bit if you all are interested and we have time. But it affects the Roulette family. And their youngest daughter, Carrie Mae, succumbed to the disease, to typhoid fever. And Roulette, as both of you all are aware, some of our listeners might not know, he penned a letter to a family. There was a soldier that was buried on his property, and he arranged for that the remains of that soldier to be exhumed, put in a coffin, and shipped home to the family. And that letter has been documented. Correct me if I'm wrong, John. Is that Richard Clem who has a copy of that letter?
He does, and
Okay.
that's how I met Richard Clem. But the family, the soldier was named Robert Hubbard. He was in the 14th Connecticut. He was killed by friendly fire, and his descendants live in Middletown. I've actually met them,
Fantastic.
and it's really amazing. But go ahead. It's a great story.
Yeah, so Roulette, he's basically the family has sent him some money to arrange for the shipment. Roulette bills them just for the expenses that he incurred, and he sends them back the change, whatever was left over for paying the undertaker and the ship, the freighting and so forth. And he mentions he sends a little side note along with the letter, just letting him know that his neighbors have lost all their property, and he's lost everything, including his youngest daughter, who is a charming little girl just beginning to talk. I believe she was 1 years old, possibly 2 years old. Just heartbreaking, but he still had the kind spirit to send this nice note to these people and to take care of them, to bring closure to that family, or to at least help them move closer to finding some sort of peace from their loss.
Steve, we're gonna let you off the hook for this episode. The next episode we have you on, we're gonna get into William Roulette as the Samaritan, because I'm okay with some good speculation on good research. We'll let that pass now. But you did mention the disease. Why don't you let us know what you were kind of getting at there?
Yeah, Sharpsburg still to this day has issues with contamination with their water supply. And it was no different back then. We know that there have been outbreaks in the Sharpsburg area. I believe it might have been in the early 1900s, also 1966. There were outbreaks of hepatitis and typhoid fever from farmers cleaning out their privies too close to town run. Some of that bacteria got into the water, and then it made contact with Sharpsburg's Big Spring. For those who aren't aware with the Great Spring, it's in the center of the town, and it's where people It's where people in town, attain their water for not for themselves, not just for themselves, but also for their animals. So that water supply is all part of this system of topography in the Sharpsburg area, known as karst terrain. It's soluble limestone. It does not have a filtering system to protect sources of water from deadly bacteria. And it doesn't take much when you have all these sinkholes and cavities and streams that wash into the water supply. It doesn't take much, even to this day, for harmful bacteria to wash into the actual underground streams that make contact with springs and drilled wells and so forth. So what happened? What do we have after the battle? We have corpses that are laying everywhere for several days that were eventually they were shallowly buried. Hundreds of dead army horses, amputated limbs, piles everywhere. And then, without going into too much disgusting detail, we have to take into account that there were about 75,000 men and officers encamped in the Sharpsburg area for about 6 weeks after the battle. Where were they going to the bathroom, and what was happening to the bacteria in their bowel discharges? Swarms of houseflies were attracted to all of this matter on the surface. So whatever wasn't being leached into the groundwater was being spread by houseflies. There was one account from a soldier who compared the spreading of typhoid fever during the Civil War from latrines from the soldiers' encampments to the kitchen area where the food was being processed. They referred to that as a highway of disease, because one of the biggest spreaders of typhoid fever is the housefly. You got to think of how many flies were all over the battlefield in the days after the battle. Typhoid fever was the biggest killer for soldiers and citizens alike. There was also chronic diarrhea, dysentery, and then as the cooler winter months rolled around, like November, December, January, that's when we started seeing diphtheria come in. So it was just terrible. There were we don't know how many soldiers died as a result, but think about all these men who are struggling to survive their wounds from the battle, who now are exposed to these diseases spreading into all these field hospitals. It went to the civilian population, and I was fortunate to have access to the medical records of Dr. Augustin A. Biggs. He was Sharpsburg's doctor during the war, and he was a very meticulous records keeper. And his original daybooks are archived in the Western Maryland Room in Hagerstown. And I was fortunate, with the help of, I got to give a shout out here to John Fry and Elizabeth Howe for connecting me with those records. They were fantastic in helping me with my research. But I was able to have access to all of Dr. Biggs's medical records. And what he did, these daybooks were chronological listings of his house calls. The man made house calls throughout the entire area, recorded everything by day, listed all of his patients that he saw and the order he attended them, along with medicines dispensed. So when you have access to all those records going back before the battle and going far after into 1863 and 1864, that gave me the ability to kind of look for spikes and trends in the records. And then I was able to compare that to death and burial records from 1850 to 1870, and everything lined up in Biggs's medical records and the death and burial records, a spike in the days following the Battle of Antietam in the civilian population. And it was really actually that process of researching that chapter of this book was quite chilling when I started, putting all the numbers together just to watch. You're almost watching in real time when you're going through Biggs's records of seeing this epidemic get worse and worse and worse until his patient load quadrupled. And you're seeing trends in the civilian deaths that are quadrupling their normal average. It was tragic. And I wasn't able to really figure out an exact figure of how many people died as a direct result, but I can tell you that it was in the dozens.
And our listeners should know, Steve, the level of detail in Steve's book is astounding. It really is. I'm blown away by it. But here's another question for you. The farmers, of course, weren't the only citizens affected by the Battle of Antietam. And what was sort of a revelation for me was what happened to the folks who lived in town. And many of those houses you can, still exist today, and our listeners can go and view them from the outside. So tell us a little bit about what was the experience for the people who lived in Sharpsburg, and how many people lived in Sharpsburg in 1862?
The census is really spotty to determine how many people actually lived in the town in based on the 1860 census. But Sharpsburg overall, we know, hasn't grown much from then to today. As a matter of fact, I think the population today might be a little bit less of what it was back then. Might have been if I had, it's hard to say. But I know that the district of Sharpsburg, which stretched all the way almost to Bakersville to the north, all the way to the Potomac River west and south, down towards almost like the Miller's Sawmill area and so forth, was 2,400 residents. So what it was like living in town during the battle is it was occupied by the Confederate Army. They came in on the morning of the 15th, and the town was overrun with Confederates. Sharpsburg had a lot of Southern sympathizers living in town, but it was predominantly, based on my research, predominantly Union. So you can imagine what it was like from a, you know, a Union sympathizing community being overtaken by the Confederates. But it was the artillery that keeps coming up in the war claims as being one of the biggest factors that terrified the people. Because on the 16th, you got that's it's one thing that that's it's important for people to understand if you want to know about how the town suffered. There were about 30 Confederate guns of artillery that were posted on the on that high ground that's east. Just on the east edge of town, which is roughly in the vicinity where the National Cemetery and the Citizens Cemetery now stand. And those Confederate guns drew the fire of the guns of position, the Federal Reserve artillery. That happened on the 16th to start. There was an incredibly violent artillery duel that lasted for about an hour, hour and a half, I believe. And then on the 17th, it was all day. So all these shells that were any shells that missed their targets and sailed overhead over those Confederate batteries, the geography warranted that those projectiles were going to crash into the town. And the accounts of the Confederates and of the Union troops when they finally occupied the town were just astonishing to read. It's just there's so many of them that described how bad the town was battered. Almost every building in the town, according to some accounts, took some form of damage. Windows shattered, chimneys sheared off, many houses caught fire, and as I had mentioned earlier, two homes burned to the ground. But some of the people had not left the town. There were dozens of folks in the cellars and the basements who were trapped down there while all this bombardment's taking place. And an interesting thing, I mentioned that in the book, but there's a gentleman who lived on East Main Street. Some people may be familiar with the Kretzers. Well, John Kretzer gave testimony in a war claims case that he was down in his cellar with 75 people during this span of 3 days or so, with family pets and all kinds of, you know, people of all ages and races and classes, just trapped in these cellars as the town's under fire.
And that house still stands, right, Steve?
Still stands to this day, stone house on East Main Street.
Tom, before we continue, I think I have a little business to take care of.
I
Is that
think you
okay?
do. I think you do.
I need to tell our listeners that this excellent podcast, is brought to you by Civil War Trails, the world's largest open-air museum, offering over 1,500 sites across 6 states, including over 2 dozen stops along their Antietam campaign driving trail. And you can request a free brochure from civilwartrails.org. And when you see a Civil War Trails marker, Tom, what should you do?
You lean next to the marker, you turn your phone around, you take a signed selfie, and you post it with hashtag signed selfie. And Drew will repost it and send it all over the world. So there.
Yes, indeed. And I'm sure Steve has seen many of these signs too and enjoys them immensely, right?
Oh, I'll tell you what, it being someone who, you know, I conducted all this research from my home base in East Tennessee. I'd never been to Maryland before. So when I first began the research, it was easy to get around the Sharpsburg area in the battlefield, but once I started branching out to study the Maryland campaign, like Burkittsville, Middletown, Frederick, Funkstown, I was relying heavily on my, you know, cue the sponsor, my Civil War Trails map that got me where I needed to go. So this is before the age of, you know, all this nice accessible GPS that I might have had to cheat if I could get a signal up there, right? But this Civil War Trails map I still have in my car to this day. Fantastic help.
Executive Director Drew Gruber is now your best, is he's consider you his
Yeah.
best friend. Here's another question for you, Steve. I'm curious. I like to think that I have spent, and Tom too, a lot of time in Sharpsburg, Maryland. You, however, probably have exceeded my time there by tenfold. So, how much time did you spend researching in Sharpsburg and the surrounding area, walking the fields? Because you and I visited the Hoffman Farm one day. A fabulous experience for me because your knowledge is so deep and so beyond. You're the expert on this, and it's really amazing. So, how much time did you spend in Sharpsburg researching for the book?
It's I've honestly lost track of how many trips. I used to keep tabs, John, but I've lost track over time. But it was at least a couple dozen before I lost track. What I did was, in my early stages, I was just really trying to understand, as I'd mentioned earlier, really understand the battle and the campaign. So I'd go up there and just hike the battlefield. You could find me at every anniversary weekend, every September, tagging along with the park rangers, especially Rangers Brian and Keith, just peppering them with any questions that I could, have time to ask. But I took a number of other trips up there, and once I became a little more ingrained into the research, I started leaning on a wonderful group. I highly recommend them, Antietam Battlefield Guides. I went ahead and hired them, trying to help me get acquainted so that I could ask a lot of questions during my hikes across the cornfield or drives across South Mountain and so forth. So all that became extremely helpful. That's just something that I really would like to emphasize, is that I see my work as almost a collaboration, because there were so many people that educated me along the way. Because once I conducted all the field research that I felt that I needed for the civilian portion, that's when I went into the repositories. So I had mentioned the Western Maryland room earlier, but I have to tip my hat to Ted Alexander, the late and great Ted Alexander, former chief historian of the Antietam National Battlefield, at the Resource Center, at their library there, along with Stephanie Gray. They were huge in helping me with locating anything related to civilians there. And there was the Washington County Historical Society and others in the town of Sharpsburg, like Vernell and Tim Doyle and John Schilt, who you all mentioned earlier. He was one of the first persons who I hired for tours with Antietam Battlefield Guide. And I consider John a friend. He was so kind to me, not only in tutoring me about Antietam, but he encouraged me to write this book. He was really kind of a champion in my early stages of my research, when I was doubting whether or not I had enough evidence to move forward with it. He told me just to go for it, and it lit a fire under me and gave me the confidence that I needed to move forward.
Steve, we're jumping around a little bit here. We're jumping to a year after the battle. I'll read another excerpt from your book, just about how people were getting frustrated and almost bitter. You quote one of the local papers, the Herald of Freedom and Torchlight, that's the name of the newspaper, complained. This is August of 1863. "We have been invaded, our fences burned, our wheat crops obliterated from the face of the earth, our stock driven off, our farms and houses pillaged. If because of our allegiance to it have we lost everything, ought it not to make some return for the sacrifice? Many of us are ruined. We are as naked in property as we were in the flesh when we were born into the world. They're complaining with the government. They haven't heard. They haven't gotten money. How long did this go on?"
Oh, if you were there, it seemed to take forever, and for good reason, because the war claims process and its any steps that you needed to take to receive payment, it was an incredibly difficult challenge, a path for these people to navigate. I'll give you the example of William Roulette, who we had described earlier. All the property that I had mentioned that the Roulettes lost, they went through multiple phases of the claims process, stretching out all the way up until, I believe, 1900 is when the final case for the Roulettes was settled, if I'm not mistaken. And all that they received ultimately was, I think it was $15 for 1 ton of hay that was lost. And that's because Roulette had managed to, I think he was able to procure a receipt from a driver of an ambulance or a wagon master or something. But this was in comparison to about, $2,000 or $3,000 worth of property that he was trying to seek repayment for from the federal government. So, long story short, I'll just try to keep this explanation short for the listeners. There were three phases of three congressional acts that passed to allow these Marylanders and other members of the residents of the border states to pursue claims compensation. This differed if you were a Union loyal person living in a southern state, in a former Confederate state after the war. That fell under the jurisdiction of the Southern Claims Commission. But for the Sharpsburg residents, they weren't able to actually see their claims investigated until the mid-1870s. That's how long it took. These people were desperate for money after McClellan's army left at the latter part of October 1862. They needed to be paid then and there. But we find themselves, based on all the claims evidence, you know, it wasn't until the 1870s that all this began. And what we find is the rules under that act of July 4, 1864, the first act, it was so strict in requiring these people to prove the merits of their case, all the property that was taken, and their loyalty to the Union. They had to go through hoops and barrels to prove their loyalty to the Union, and most of these people were Unionists. So what we find under that act is that the average person, more than half the people, their claims were outright rejected. And of the people who did receive settlements, they received on average about 15% is what I tallied, about 15% of their total amount claimed. Now, if you accepted that payment, that small payment from the U.S. government, from the Treasury, you were required to forever relinquish your unpaid balance. That was it. That was all you were going to get. If you had been completely rejected, then you could refile your claim under the later acts that were passed in 1883 and 1887. Ultimately, those latter claims, they stretched into the 1900s. And if you can believe this, the last claims that I reviewed related to Antietam were closed 53 years later after the battle in the year 1915.
That's amazing. Steve, did any of those folks just throw their hands up and say, I'm getting the heck out of here, we're moving?
Tons of them, John. Yeah, there were so many people that left the area. And that's a little difficult to distinguish when it comes, because I've been asked that question in some of my talks, like how many people left as a direct result of the battle and its aftermath. It's hard to pinpoint that exactly. We know that there are people who lost everything and left as a result, like the prize, like the newcomers, tenant farmers, like the Canoed family up in Bakersville. There's so many of those stories. But there were also those, especially the children of the battlefield farmers and the 1862 residents, the heads of household at that time, their children were the ones who left in droves. And it makes me wonder how many of them left because there just was an opportunity in farming in the very challenging post-war economy, or if it was also because of all these opportunities that were opening up out west, because that's where most of them went. They went to Illinois. They went to Kansas and Nebraska. If you can believe this, the Mumma, there were several members of the Mumma family, the David R. Miller family, the Blackfords, they all ended up in this same settlement out in the Sacramento Valley out in California. So many people moved to that area that they nicknamed it the Maryland Colony. All these people from Washington County.
That's a great story. That's an awesome story. I want to get back to the research process briefly because I'm fascinated. 15 years of your life you devote to this. Did you, besides going to these repositories, did you find that residents of Western Maryland in general and in Sharpsburg specifically opened up to you and gave you information that you were able to incorporate into the book?
There were some, absolutely. But, you know, when I began this project, I mean, that's I didn't really know that many people up there. And I was just a fly on the wall. I was kind of a ghost. If I had gone in, it'd be a lot easier if I were an established author. And, you know, I could call up a lot of people and ask for favors. I don't think I had that confidence yet to just start leaning on people to connect me. But you had mentioned Earl Roulette, you know, some of my Sharpsburg connections that I had set me up with a time where I was able to spend an afternoon with Earl and Annabelle Roulette and see their relics that you had described. And there were a lot of people, there were some situations where I connected with people online as well. There were some genealogists of family, descendants of like Solomon Lum or the Grove family who lent me all the information they had on the genealogies. So there were a lot of people that I connected with online. I wish I had met more in Sharpsburg, like some of the surviving residents. But now that the book has come out, I've had the pleasure of meeting all types of people who are descendants of the people of the 1862 residents, and also some people who live on some of the properties that are off the battlefield area, some of those homes that were encamped upon and fought over that are just outside of the park boundaries. So that's been a special treat to meet them as well.
Tom and I need to hang with you during one of those visits, by the way.
John,
So,
I think I need to lean on you with all your connections because you are the man when it comes to
no.
that.
He is. Hey, Steve, one of the many things that interested me in your book was as they went through their claims, some of these folks had to prove to the government that they were loyal to the Union. Correct. And one family that, as you know, you've helped me with some of my own research on this, with the Miller family of Miller Cornfield fame, where David R. Miller, you know, it's called the David R. Miller Cornfield. But what a lot of people don't seem to know is he had a brother, William, who was in the Confederate Army, didn't fight at Sharpsburg, but was in the Confederate Army. And two of his sisters were married to Confederate soldiers. So David R. and his father, Colonel John, who had fought in the War of 1812, both had to prove to the government and have people witness for them that they were loyal Union men. And they in fact did. But it was a process that I, even though I maybe should have thought of it, I never thought of that before I read your book, that some of these people had to go through that as well.
Yes, and if you were a resident who had a son who served in the Confederate Army, that was about one of the worst strokes of luck you could have if you're trying to secure claims compensation, because you had to bring in more witnesses to testify on your behalf. You had to procure and secure more affidavits from former Union soldiers, especially members of the Potomac Home Brigade who lived in Sharpsburg, who were Union soldiers who could vouch for your loyalty. You had to just bring in just droves of people to say, yeah, he had a Confederate son, but I can tell you he was loyal to the Union. And what was really draconian in the rules under the Act of July 4, 1864, you could have 17 people come into your side and you think you're going to hit a home run and receive your full claims reimbursement. But if you had one person in the community who said they were disloyal, you weren't allowed cross-examination under that act. The investigating quartermaster agent could use that one single statement. And that's not going to help you out if you have any, personal enemies in the neighborhood or you're feuding with someone. People understood how the process worked back then. So if someone wanted to sabotage your claim, they could, under that first act, say something bad behind your back, and you wouldn't know about it until you were allowed to read the final report. But you couldn't, once the claim was decided upon by Quartermaster General Montgomery C. Meigs, they couldn't reopen it. It was already decided. So you had a copy of your claim, but you could do nothing about it. So it was just terrible. Now, the later two acts under the Bowman and Tucker Acts, those allowed claimants cross-examination. That's when you really start seeing the sleeves get rolled up and it's a boxing match back and forth. Some of those depositions are quite lengthy.
That's like Soviet Union 1956, it seems like, a little bit. Steve, what surprised you in the course of your digging and reporting for this book? What one or two things did you say, oh my gosh, this is wild?
Simple answer to that, John, would be the scope. When I began researching this, I saw Antietam as really just battlefields within the scope of the battlefield proper, and some residents in the town of Sharpsburg, and these poor people, right? Well, as I continued to research over the years, and I collected, especially when I located the war claims, I went to Washington hoping to find maybe 25 additional claims for these people, and I walked away with about 250, and that's when it really hit me, when I thought the scope. In a 5-mile radius of so many people, not just impacted, but impacted heavily, losing so much of their property, wiped out countless families. That's when it hit me that the scope of Antietam and its aftermath was much greater than what I had previously imagined.
Steve, when I went on the Antietam Institute symposium tour last spring with you and Chris Vincent of the Farmsteads, there were so many fascinating stories, and I don't remember all the details for this one, so I'm going to ask the dangerous open-ended question. We were at the Pry Farm, I think, and there's a story about these people also were victimized by lawyers in town. Do you know the ones I'm talking to? They took advantage of these poor folks, and I was, as you were telling that story, I was just fascinated.
Yes, when I first started researching, I'd come across a couple accounts saying, yeah, civilians, they were known to fabricate their accounts and exaggerate and inflame them, but and inflate the values and so forth. But what I found in looking through the processes of the war claims is that everything had to follow a very strict set of rules and criteria, and all the witnesses that you had to bring in also had to go through steps to be sworn in, so that it was really kind of just built in to, the agents would compare your quantities with your neighbors and so forth. So everything was really kind of strictly monitored to prevent against that type of exaggeration, if you will, to inflate the quantity and receive a bigger settlement. But that's where the lawyers came in. That's where lawyers got in trouble, and at least I found in my research where they would come in and they were caught, several of them, altering the actual petitions that had been created and drafted by the witnesses. You had to have appraisers that were going to be the ones to draft all your petitions for you. You couldn't do it yourself. You had to have unbiased appraisers. But the official documents submitted, we find lawyers actually erasing some of the values and trying to, put in like, you couldn't change. Like, if you lost a bushel of corn back in 1862, it was set at a price of 60 cents a bushel. You couldn't change that price. But the lawyers knew you could change the quantities. So instead of 100 bushels, maybe you could turn that one into a four. And now you're going to make a little more money. That's where some of the lawyers were caught. But in the case of the Pry family, that was a real doozy, because Philip Pry had a claim that was somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000, if my memory serves correctly. And he was waiting and waiting and waiting to hear from the government. And they finally look into his case and said, we paid that claim years ago. We sent it to your lawyer. And you can almost imagine the awkward pause that followed. But yeah, anyways, I would love to be a fly on the wall when Pry confronted his attorney to ask for the repayment, because what happened was Pry still had other claims that were pending, and the United States government through the Treasury wasn't going to pay him for those claims until he repaid the amount. His lawyer, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but his lawyer did not only take the payment and refuse to pay Pry, but the lawyer had inflated the quantities in the claim, putting in a line item of like oats and rye, things that Pry said he never raised in 1862. They were just false line items. So not only did Pry not get paid from his claim, but he had to repay the amount that his attorney had inflated. And the government wanted him to do all this on his own accord. And then they would send him the rest of the bill that he was owed. Well, he couldn't get that money from his attorney for whatever reason. And that was part of the reason why the Pry family was ruined and had to move to Tennessee.
Steve, this is truly outstanding stuff. You're the world's foremost expert on this topic. And we could go on for a couple, we could hold a marathon podcast with you down the road. But in the final few minutes here, curious, is there, I liken Antietam and Sharpsburg, it's like 1862 under a bubble. It's really special for me to go there, and for Tom, and I'm sure for you. Is there, I'm going to lob a softball to you here. Is there, do you have a favorite spot on the battlefield, a place that you think, man, when I go back, I can't wait to go to X?
I've done a lot of thinking, right when I get off the road from my seven and a half hour drive, I usually kind of just de-stress by going to the New York Monument right there by the Visitor Center and just sit there and take in, the scene, looking towards the mountains, looking out towards the Miller cornfield. But when I get out on the field, one place that I've especially enjoyed, I like the Tidball Bluff. When you take that trail up there, I love the panoramic view, and also the Hawkins Monument, because every time I've been there, it's been so quiet. I haven't just come across people, because it's kind of off the beaten path. But the view there as well, it's just so peaceful and serene. So I would have to say those three are the first three that come to mind as being my favorite.
Those are good ones. Those are good ones.
You've done such great work here. You've met people since then. Is there something else coming from Steve Cowley, or is this going to be the one book?
Well, originally when I finished it, I said it was going to be one, because I didn't realize how much work it was going to be, not only to research it and write it, but to promote it. Because Savis Beatty has done a fantastic job with keeping me busy. I'm so fortunate that they published the book. I mean, they're still keeping me quite busy to this day. So I have other things on my plate right now as well that are keeping me from taking a deep dive into research, but there is more that I want to do on Antietam. I do have a couple projects in the works, but I don't know when I'm going to be able to finish them just yet because I'm just trying to wait for some other things to be removed from my plate so that I can focus on it like I did before with this When Hell Came to Sharpsburg project.
That's outstanding. Well, Steve, we can't thank you enough. Tom and I will probably combine and give you a $2 gift certificate to Nutter's in town in Sharpsburg, Nutter's Ice Cream, where you can take that and probably get 28 gallons of ice cream for $2. A little inside joke for people who've never been to Nutter's, where they have tremendous ice cream. We may have to make them another semi-official sponsor, Tom.
We have numerous semi-official sponsors, Steve.
It's pretty amazing. But When Hell Came to Sharpsburg, it's a tremendous book. And for listeners out there, I highly recommend this, and Tom does too. Tom, I think we might hear.
We had the Irish music last time. I think those are the banjos.
Steve, do you hear the banjos too?
I think I hear some banjos starting to rise in volume, gentlemen. And as we exit out, I just want to thank you once again for your time. I've had a joy talking to you both.
It's outstanding.
Steve,
And
it's been awesome. Thanks.
let's go to the banjos.